Hey guys, I'm here today with an interview with Tristan Sykes and Kate Booth. They are activists and have a website called justcollapse.org. Followed them for a while and wanted to catch up with them in terms of the climate crisis and what we're facing. So, Kate and Tristan, thanks for reaching out and taking the time to chat today.
G'day, James. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah. Hi, James. Nice to meet you. And I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Awesome. And just to be clear, you guys are in Australia right now, or?
Yeah, we're in Australia, actually in Tasmania, which is the island state off the south of Australia. Yeah.
Gotcha. So tell us a little bit about your background and about how you came to put together the website Just Collapse.
Sure. Thanks, James. We both have a long history of activism, and having gone through various iterations through peace and environmental movements and organizations, most recently we were both involved with the Extinction Rebellion, and we think, you know, that was very effective at raising awareness of the climate predicament, but our predicament is much larger than climate itself. And so we thought that what we'd done in Extinction Rebellion was effective, but we felt that we needed to turn over a new leaf and start something that addressed the full scale of the climate ecological global predicament, and that's why we created Just Collapse.
Yeah, we had a realization that even though there's been numerous important small gains by the social justice and environmental movements over decades, that none of these things had actually changed our overall trajectory. So we needed to start talking about the worst case scenario, because we are in the worst case scenario.
Yeah, definitely.
So before your involvement with, when did you get involved with Extinction Rebellion and really kind of embracing the need for working towards change on climate change? Like where in time did you come to that realization yourselves?
I mean, certainly I'd been aware of how serious the climate situation was since, you know, the early 2000 and teens, you know, like 2013 or such. You know, when I became aware that Extinction Rebellion was forming in the UK, I thought, if there's an opportunity to get things moving here in Australia, then I'd like to get involved with that. And so I sort of founded the state's chapter in Tasmania down here. And Kate later joined in and became action coordinator, and we presided over, you know, mass arrests and various disruptive activities in order to raise awareness of our climate predicament. But of course, it's more than that. There's a ecological predicament, and we both feel very strongly that sort of a narrow focus on CO2 doesn't recognize some of the broader structural issues that underpin our predicament, like infinite growth on a finite planet and the nature of ecological and biodiversity collapse. And so we found the Extinction Rebellion focus a little narrow in what it was trying to communicate. And so we wanted to, you know, come at it from more of a I suppose, a more holistic kind of approach that incorporated limits to growth and ecological biodiversity collapse.
Yeah, and another aspect of the structure that is informing our current trajectory is inequity and inequality around the world, and how that maps onto global ecological and climatic change. So that was something else that we believed, as well, we believe has to be at the forefront of all conversations.
Yeah, and perhaps I can provide a little example of this, is that the there's sort of the narrow focus on CO2 that is incredibly pervasive among climate activists. It leads to these maladaptive solutions, because if you're only addressing a symptom of the predicament, you're not acting in recognition, you know, of what the fundamental drivers are. You're just treating the symptom of CO2 and going, oh well, you know, somehow this is a solution. Whereas, you know, in fact, the solutions that are currently being proposed to solve CO2 are likely to actually exacerbate the overall predicament rather than solve anything. And so this sort of misidentification of the underlying predicament leads to maladaptive actions and outcomes.
So how do we change the behavior in terms of being able to have better outcomes then?
Just collapse isn't, we're not so concerned about changing behavior. We've got a somewhat different strategy and theory of change, because in exploring the idea of the inevitability of climate ecological collapse, and with it societal collapse, we need to recognize that changes ideas, prevalent ideas of what action and politics means. So we've been through this substantial, important period of history, and this is in the Western world, of activism based on the idea of progress. And there have been huge, significant wins in that regard. So women's rights, civil rights, some environmental gains, and so on and so forth. This has all been important, recognising also that this is against a backdrop of the ongoing legacy of colonialization as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not all good news. It really depends on who you are and where you are. Some people and communities and places have been on the receiving end of absolutely devastating violence and repression. So thinking about collapse going forward, we need to rethink politics and action. If collapse is inevitable, what does that mean for how we think about politics? If it's not about progress, if it's not about making the world a better place, because we just can't at this point in history.
We're too far into overshoot. So this is another, the fundamental predicament is that we have, we're consuming the resources of the earth at an extraordinary rate, far beyond the capacity for the earth to regenerate or replenish. Uh-huh. And we've overstepped 6 of 9 planetary boundaries, severely limiting the capacity for the planet to provide the services that support life on Earth, and that we are moving from a period of what has been extraordinary exponential increase in population and consumption to a period of decline and collapse, because the limits, we are hard up against the limits to growth and the limits of progress, and we're proceeding down the other side. And so we're exploring what kind of socio-ecological justice can be affected in a period of decline and collapse, as opposed to the era of progress that we've become so accustomed to.
So have you had any successes in that regard? I mean, what have you been able to kind of piece together in the time that you've taken that approach?
So we call our theory of change riding the zeitgeist. So we're riding the zeitgeist, the collapse zeitgeist. That's how we understand what we do. So
are
context,
are you saying saying writing as in where you're making notes of like how it's going, or you're riding like a bronco, like you know, it's kind of this wild beast that you really don't have any control over.
Yeah, we're locating ourselves within the change that's happening, the inevitable change, and as Tristan said, working out what we can do within that context. So by way of example, one of the things we advocate for is insurgent planning, and that is communities and groups of people taking action and organizing themselves in response to greater hardship. Now, insurgent planning is something, it's an academic framing for a particular mode of action. It's been happening in poorer communities around the world for decades or centuries. You know, people just have had to have come together and act outside of government and regulatory frameworks in order to meet their own basic needs.
Yeah.
So we're saying that this has happened, it is happening around the world, and it will increasingly happen as times get tough. And in the Western world, the cost of living crisis is part of the context of collapse, of social, economic, resource decline and collapse. And within that, we will see more and more communities and people organizing themselves in that regard.
Yeah, so rather than sort of the classic notions of prepping, we're trying to activate communities to organize collectively for their own resilience.
So how would you define a community, like a small town or a, you know, a church with its you know, members, you know, within a geographical location, for example, the Black community or the Latino community? I mean, how do you define like groups that would organize? I mean, because are you talking
in America,
about cross borders or, you know?
Yeah, well, in America, there's a good example. There's a good example called Occupy Jackson, which is a community based organization around resilience and social justice, which you know, which some of your listeners will probably be aware of. But these kinds of organizations are happening all around the world in different forms. And Kate can speak to some of this.
Yeah, because collapse happens differently in different places and affects people differently, depending on who you are and where you are, we as a platform, as a Just Collapse platform, take a decentralized view of how people should or would organize, because we just, you know, the world is a complex place. We can't tell people in different parts of the world what their community looks like or should look like or what their response needs to be, because the world's too big, it's too complex. It's not our role to do that. It's not useful for us to try and do that. So it's where people are at defines their community. So if people are active within a church, sure. If they're active within another form of local organization, sure. Or if they're deliberately bringing together people within their street and neighborhood, that's another example. And at the moment, while global connectivity, communications is still happening, those networks and that kind of organizing can happen beyond local communities. But what we see as part of collapse is what some term as a radical relocalization. You know, we will be pulled back closer and closer to where we are. The resources that we have available to us will be more immediate and not coming in via international shipping or air flights. So, you know, we can act with more agency and more broader connectivity now. But this is kind of an idea of solidarity prepping. That's a word that's used in different parts of the world to describe insurgent planning. Solidarity prepping will become more and more localized as we move forward, just as it already is in many parts of the world. You know, we are very conscious we're speaking from a privileged Western position here, but many parts of the world are already hyper-dependent on their local places and are not so connected.
It seems to me like what you're describing is kind of an anarchist view of society, you know, one which is really based on, like you said, the local need and something that's very specific to a group of people in a specific area.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, certainly we're influenced by, you know, that critiques of power and anarchist critique of power is a very useful perspective that we acknowledge and embrace.
Yeah, and it's important to clarify, we're not setting, when we talk about solidarity prepping or insurgent planning together, prepping together, we're not defining a vision of the future that we should be aiming for. This is inevitable.
Yeah.
You know, as things break down, this is inevitable. So again, we're different from what a lot of NGOs or climate, environmental, social justice movements do. The usual formula is to create a vision for the future and say, if we do A, B, and C, we will achieve this vision, this better world. Degrowth's a classic example. Very strong vision of what the world could or should look like. We don't do that. We recognize that in the process of climate ecological collapse, we're losing agency every day, every natural disaster, every rise in geopolitical conflict, every breakdown in the supply chain, global supply chains means we're losing agency. So we don't say this is what the future we should be aiming for is. What we say is local organization working together to meet basic needs in hard and difficult times is inevitable. This is the future we're heading into. It's already, as we said, it's already the present for many people.
We're advocating that people, you know, to some degree get ahead of this by recognizing the reality, the predicament that we're in and the inevitable trajectory of that predicament and undertake some degree of solidaristic prepping, planning in view of how to uphold notions of socio-ecological justice in face of global climate, ecological, social collapse.
It's interesting because the system that we all have to operate in has, for as long as I can remember, it feels like we are driven apart from each other, right? We're separated and we're trained as consumers and citizens to not work in a coordinated fashion, to not, you know, seek out other connections. You look at the breakdown of church in the United States, of community organizations, and, you know, this idea that we need to build community, I think, is really essential, but it's something that, by and large, most people don't have experience with, right? And it, you know, it's not something you can just pick up. It takes a learning curve, and you have to, like you said, start earlier rather than waiting until, you know, quote unquote.
Yeah, particularly the West.
Late.
Yeah, I think particularly the West sort of has sort of struggled around this kind of communality, this kind of community, because we've been atomized and hyper-individualized yep. by corporate capitalism.
Yeah.
Not just that, fossil fuels have enabled us to buy tech to do, for example, in the home, to do what things that we might have had to have worked with neighbors to do in previous yep. existence, or even with family members. You know, you had to team together to get stuff done. Fossil fuels, this abundant source of energy, which is now diminishing at a rapid rate, but this abundant source of energy has enabled us to retreat as well. You know, it's capitalism is definitely part of that, and the individualization that's enacted through neoliberalism as well. But it's the energy source.
So in the West, I mean, this is more prevalent than elsewhere. And yeah, we're definitely trying to get these notions of community organization, you know, more thought about in the West, because it is an atomized, hyper-individualistic sort of social organization where people are expected to look after themselves. Not, you know, there is no there's less kind of community recognition than perhaps in other countries.
There's still, yeah, not diminishing that, but there is still a high level of cooperation within Western societies. It's just not the same that, I guess, that would fall under that label of community. For example, my favourite example is traffic lights. So in our part of the world and other parts of the Western world, everyone cooperates on the basis of red and green signals. Like, that is a phenomenal act of collectivity, that we all agree to these basic road rules so that things more and less go smoothly during transport. So yes, there has been a breakdown in community and there's a hyper individualization, but once you start looking, you can also see all these patterns of cooperation as well.
Humans are very social, very cooperative species, and there's evidence of this all around the world. People often think the collapse leads to some kind of Mad Max, chaotic, nightmarish situation. But in reality, when push comes to shove, people do move into situations of collective organization, whether in times of war or times of natural disaster. And we don't see this being any different.
Yeah. Noting that things can also go horribly wrong. We're not painting an idealized romantic view of human relations. You know, there's plenty of examples around the world.
Yeah, I mean, your example with the traffic light, I agree with, and by the same token, in the United States, it feels like when you look at the current political system and situation, especially with Trump, that a lot of basic recognition of law and kind of things that are community norms are now, you know, threatened and seem to be undercut. And so it kind of leaves you with, you know, is there really any support or protection from, you know, the system itself? So that's kind of my take.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting things happening in the States. Very worrisome, absolutely. This is part of the sort of the social decline. What was promised can no longer be promised, as you be be very aware of in America, that the process of neoliberalism has sort of stagnated progress for most, while funneling funneling wealth to oligarchs, to incredibly small numbers of increasingly rich people. And while infrastructure and human lives are sort of cast aside, it's a tragedy, and there doesn't seem to be, as far as I can tell, a political solution to what is really an approach to of limits, and that we're entering into a period of decline. The kind of gains that were made under the progress prior to neoliberalism just aren't capable of being maintained anymore. And as we enter this sort of long decline, we need to look to each other to try to secure human dignity in mutual solidarity.
So we have a little book of insurgent planning on our website, which includes examples from around the world of how communities have self-organized and sometimes resisted government, things like that. And there's an example in there from the US as well as different places. Yep.
Well, I look forward to reading that. Are you suggesting that the first step is really just reaching out to neighbors and starting from there? I mean, how do you start the process of insurgent planning? I don't know.
Yeah, we've got a campaign. Our current campaign is Talk Collapse, which is, if you understand the nature and severity of our global predicament, then there is an opportunity to communicate that. And that's a matter of justice that everyone has the right to know. Not everyone wants to know, obviously.
And I would say that that's the majority of people. And my experience is that there's a large portion of society is aware of what's going on, but really doesn't want to have to deal with it or face kind of the I guess moral quandaries or the questions that, you know, facing it kind of dictates, you know.
Yeah, so meeting people on their own terms we found really useful when talking collapse. So if you know, we don't ram our particular worldview down people's throats in day-to-day life, in our personal connections. You know, you can talk about the cost of living crisis with people. That's part of the breakdown. So that's one thing. So back to your question about where you start, whether you start talking to neighbours, you can start talking to anybody. But one of the key things we picked up, because we reviewed a lot of the academic research into examples of insurgent planning. And one of the things we picked up was that existing organizations within communities and within areas are a useful starting point. So not trying to artificially construct a community. Lots of examples where that can go pear-shaped. Sometimes it works, often it goes pear-shaped because you're starting from scratch to try and build something really complex and nuanced. Yeah. So reaching out to organisations that already exist in your local area and just saying hi and volunteering or turning up to events or whatever. And, you know, picking your organisation that you're comfortable with. Obviously, not all organisations are adaptable or inclusive. But identifying those organisations that might have been running for decades or hundreds of years in some cases that have this demonstrated historic capacity to adapt and change and act within a changing world.
Yeah, and these groups historically do, in times of natural disasters and conflict, they have brought people together to because the structures already exist, they very quickly mobilize. And so, you know, whether this is church groups or tidy towns or whatever you know, sort of local organization best suits. These are great things to get involved with at the local level, so that community can be bolstered and encouraged, and some degree of resilience can be had.
What's your feeling as far as with the this idea of building local, but then you have within society the larger government or the larger kind of apparatus, which really doesn't want to accept change? And like, how do you deal with that conflict between what you're going to want to do on a local basis, but then being opposed by kind of the larger society around you? Do you just kind of ignore that, or do you confront that? Like, how do you manage that relationship?
Yeah, it's kind of up to individuals in due to their various circumstances and in various places. I mean, it's potentially more difficult in China than in Shanghai than it might be in Jackson, in America. But you know, there is structural opposition, which can be faced in different ways, and sometimes that has required people to just, like in the case of Occupy, to resist and to hold places in face of opposition. And sometimes, it really depends on where you are and what the situation is. We wouldn't suggest that there's any kind of boilerplate.
I wouldn't think so, but I'm just interested. That's always been a question, I think, that kind of delays any sort of how do you get started, because it's kind of like you immediately get pushback from the larger society around you. You know what I mean? So yeah. It's an obstacle that I think that kind of puts off people's committing to this idea of kind of embracing more of the local, the need for local activism.
Yeah, so in our part of the world, and from what I understand, it's very similar in the US, the national government has its foot flat to the floor on a renewables transition in the name of climate change and CO2, but more realistically, it's an energy security response related to national security following peak oil. So that acceleration, we refer to it as a hypergrowth because it's mass investment in new infrastructure, new mines, new production, new manufacturing, is being increasingly met with resistance from local communities that are being impacted by the changes or the proposed changes and the speed of those changes. So in many ways, this kind of resistance is organic. It will happen. Mm-hmm. It'll make more sense at different times than it does now.
Examples might be Lock the Gate, where people, we've got a lot of farmers, a lot of agricultural people and communities who are resisting having mining leases put over their properties for fracking, to frack gas, to put through transmission towers, build solar farms, etc. And these agricultural communities are concerned about their aquifers, about their waterways, about their their connection to to the land, and they're responding by forming, organizing at a communal, at a community level.
Yeah, I mean, as an example, I mean, I live in Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania was one of the first states to dabble with fracking, and they, you know, even though we have a Democratic governor, you know, the power of the fossil fuel interests are really driving, and they maintain control over what can or cannot get done in terms of fossil fuels in the state. So there really is, even though there's awareness of it and activism, you know, it really is opposed by those fossil fuel interests, and they exercise that control over government itself, you know, and it's a case in point of that conflict between local interests having a clear idea of what they don't want and getting run over in the process by, you know, the powers that be, as it were. So
yeah, and that level of power being exerted by big oil and the fossil fuel sector is transposing into a similar exertion of power by the renewables, so-called renewables industry as well. It cuts across the energy sector.
Yeah. So I mean, we wouldn't separate those two, I suppose, because the renewable energy sector is part of the same energy sector that the fossil fuel sector is part of. And the ecocide that takes place as a result of blowing up enormous holes in wherever to destroying the watersheds with tailings dams and various you know, acids and pollutants, and let alone all the diesel that's required to actually, you know, to extract the ores, go through the refining. All of this is done with fossil fuel. Then the manufacturing is done with fossil fuel. And then finally the products are assembled and transported with fossil fuel. So in fact, they're exactly the same industry, just, another face of it.
One's just got green clothing. And both act to increase inequity, increase inequality. They all fit into the same system. And it's been the fact that it's being done now in the name of the environment is deeply concerning.
Yeah, we would say it's human supremacist one and eco-fascist in this regard, in that it's identifying people who want their lifestyles and their comfortable their comfort maintained, and sacrificing a whole bunch of non-human existence in order to maintain it,
and justifying it on the basis of climate and ecological grounds when actually it's doing exactly the opposite.
And this makes it eco-fascist.
Yeah.
Interesting. The so where do we go? Like, so what's the solution then? You're saying that the idea that Extinction Rebellion had in terms of focusing on CO2 doesn't really tell the whole story. Clearly, you know, the technology approach of renewables is not the solution. Is it just the fact that we have to get used to living simpler lives without the technology and without the comforts that we've had in Western society for the last 50 years, and kind of go back to something simpler?
But there is no solution to our predicament. That's something that just collapses very clear on. We don't do solutions because there are no solutions. This is an incredibly complex.
No, I don't think it's a solution. It's a matter of adaptation. How do we adapt to what's going on? And I mean, clearly, you know, one of the first podcasts that I did was with a guy from Australia. His name was Ian something. I can't remember. Ian McClellan, maybe. I'm not sure. But it was one of the first podcasts that I did. And this was probably 4 or 5 years ago. And at that time, and he used to work at like Shell and ended up becoming a climate activist after that stint of duty. And, you know, he said something that hit me like a 2x4. He said, by the end of the century, there'll be 6 billion people less on the planet. And so, I mean, is the solution to... is not the solution, but is that just the simple reality of adaptation, is the fact that the planet will make the choice for us, that there will be fewer humans, and without that number of humans, we won't have that same level of society.
Clearly. Yeah. I mean, from a very ideal position, it would be if the whole world, you know, there's a very hypothetical, because this is not what's going to happen at all, but in a hypothetical world, we would put aside our geopolitical and domestic political and economic global circumstances, and we would all rally together in recognition of our ecological overshoot predicament, and we would all unite together as one world and recognize that we have to bring the human enterprise to within planetary boundaries and ecological limits very, very rapidly, and we would all work together to do this. That's not going to happen. There is no chance that it's going to happen. There's so many things that we can't manage to achieve at the political level, let alone something as extraordinary and such an antithesis to what we're used to as global progress. It's just politically unacceptable to do. What will happen is that the decline will accelerate into collapse, and we're already experiencing this now. And so what we're saying is that we can respond to this more effectively or less effectively, and we're trying to outline some of the more effective responses that can be had in face of this inevitable decline.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not there's no win at the end of
this. No. I mean, it's a matter of, if anything, it's a matter of trying to survive to get to the next phase of whatever hellscape is left on the planet, right? to be able to see what we can do at that point, because nobody knows what it's going to be like at that point. So
yeah, this is one of the challenges that we face. This is to use an overused term, it's unprecedented. You know, we don't. The climate science indicates potentially 10 degrees of global warming from existing CO2 atmospheric emissions. 5 degrees of those are fast, my understanding of the science. Now, what that means in terms of different places and peoples around the world is catastrophic, but it's also unknown. The specifics are unknown.
And that's just the climate.
Yeah, that's just the climate. So we know that people who already marginalised, dispossessed and disadvantaged, poorer people, are being impacted, have been impacted already, and will be tend to be the first and foremost who will bear the brunt in the near-term future.
And in this regard, I would just like to say that rather than focusing on a future that might not actually happen, because there might not be a future at some point. But we don't have, the past is past. We can't prevent the past from happening. It's happened. The future, we don't know. It's uncertain. But what we do know is that we have the present, and right now, this is when we can act for socio-ecological justice. This is the only time that exists. The future may not exist. The past is already gone. We are in the present. This is when we can act.
Be here now.
Yep.
Interesting. I think that's a good place to leave it, because I really think people should check out the website. I'm definitely going to get the book, do some more reading. It's interesting that we're talking today. I spent basically all day outside working in my garden. We live in the middle of basically a city, but I've turned our backyard into our own agricultural experimentation station. So, trying to do whatever I can for, what we have going on. But definitely agree with the need to, I think the number one thing that people need to do is build community is really the solution. And it's something that, the system doesn't like and doesn't want, but it's something that is really called for and urgently needed. So I know the website is justcollapse.org. If people want to reach out to you and learn more, how can they reach out to you?
There are lots of resources on our website. I'll mention that the Little Book of Insurgent Planning is a free book. You can download it, and it's only 11 or 12 pages, so it's not an onerous read.
Good.
lots of resources on our website. We're also active on Facebook and Twitter.
And YouTube.
Yeah, and YouTube, so people can engage with us there.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, I appreciate you taking the time today to chat. And, if anything, I would love to chat more as time goes on and we kind of see how things develop. Maybe we can do this again in the future.
Oh, that'd be great.
Thanks, terrific. James. It's nice nice to meet you today.
Thanks, Tristan. Thanks, Kate. Thanks for reaching out to me. And, good luck in all that you do. And, keep up the good work.
Yeah, you too.
Yep.
Take care, all.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.